Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It's the moment we've all been waiting for, and we didn't even know we were waiting for it until it happened. And that is Roz Chast's take on aging and dying. Roz Chast, as you know, is a cartoonist for The New Yorker. Her new memoir is called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It details the aging and death of her parents. Roz, it is a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we have so enjoyed going through your book. So tell us essentially, we all know you're a cartoonist at The New Yorker, and this is a book of cartoons, but it talks about your parents getting older. Tell us what you've done here.
I hope, an interesting book. It was something I really wanted to do. It's a graphic memoir, but it's not a typical graphic memoir. It has a lot of cartoons in it. It has illustrations. It has text, although none of it is set in type. It's written in my own handwriting, and photographs, and then some non-cartoon type drawings at the end. So
Well, you have a lot of very funny stuff at the beginning of the book. Well, all through the book, actually. But at the beginning of the book, and you talk about, you know, your parents and how they got together and how they told you about their horrible lives and so forth that couldn't compete. You were so lucky. Your mother built like a fire hydrant and a peasant, and your father kind of spindly and stuff. But it's a relationship. You're dealing with – well, you talk about trying to talk to them about, you know, their plans.
The talk.
Yes, the talk. How did that go, the talk that you tried to have with your parents?
It didn't really go very well, but I have to say here that I was equally reluctant to have the talk. So we were all complicit in this avoidance of the topic. And I think, you know, why not? Because it is a terrible topic. It's an awful topic. Nobody really wants to talk about it. How do you know when you're ready to take the next step? And I didn't want to push them. I just thought maybe it would be a good idea at some point if we just sort of broached the topic, but it didn't go very well. The title of the book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, actually comes from something my father would say whenever this sort of topic would come up.
And by the way, we should put this in the context then, because I can relate to this as an only child. You're an only child.
Yes,
so,
right.
I mean, the burden falls even more heavily, even though your parents were in their 90s. So it wasn't like you're having a conversation with parents who are in their early 60s or
something like that.
It was clear it was on the horizon.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This isn't something – I mean, I've talked to people in their 20s who say, my parents are like 68 or something. And I think, no, that's not what I'm talking about.
No.
That's not what I'm talking about.
You know, can you put this in – let's talk about them for a minute before you talk about their end and how you dealt with this. One of the things that appealed to me – I used to be a housing lawyer in the South Bronx, and I dealt with a lot of people who lived in so-called Collier's mansions.
Oh, yeah.
Your parents were pack rats.
Yes.
They collected and kept everything.
Right.
You photograph it. You draw about it. You write about it. Tell us a little bit about that.
My parents were both born in 1912. Depending on how you count, I always thought – I had heard when I was growing up 10 days apart, but The New Yorker told me it's actually 11 days. So they were both born in 1912. They grew up as children of immigrants, very, very poor. Their parents didn't speak English. And they graduated from college in 1932, I think, into the Depression. And so there were a lot of factors, I think, that combined to make them, you know, almost pathologically frugal. You know, the consumption culture of the United States was something that was very foreign to them. And sometimes, you know, as I said in the book, there are aspects of it that I admired, that I thought were great. You know, you don't want to – I hate the idea of, you know, you have perfectly good silverware and then, like, let's just replace it because I'm bored, you know, and it's stupid. But
how about the pot holder, though? I mean,
tell
us about the pot holder that you drew
about.
Well,
that cartoon I did well before I ever thought about doing this book. I was visiting them. I was living in Connecticut with my family, and my parents were in Brooklyn. And I picked up this oven mitt, and it was so decrepit. It was not only – it was just like the most decrepit oven mitt that I had ever seen. It was like burnt in places, and then I realized it was patched. And it was like my mother sewed patches on an oven mitt. And then I realized that the patches of the oven mitt were made from a the fabric, I recognized it was a skirt that I had to make in seventh grade in home ec. And it was just, it was just too much.
We're talking to Roz Chass, the brilliant cartoonist. You've seen her stuff in The New Yorker forever. And she has a new book, which is huge and great. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And the topic that they're not talking about is dying.
Yeah. And for people that haven't seen the book yet, and you should get it because it's fantastic. This is all told with these great cartoons and great pictures of you and your parents with the great special facial expressions looking horrified or aghast. But dealing with something that is so universal. I mean, you talk about when your mother fell and refused to go to the hospital.
Yeah. My mother hated hospitals and, you know, with a somewhat good reason. A lot of old people do go to the hospital and then worse things happen. You know, not everybody. But she was afraid of that. She didn't want doctors. She fell off of a small step stool. And that was sort of the beginning of this more sort of precipitous decline. But what really was going on was not so much the fall off the ladder, which was bad enough, but that she also had diverticulosis, which sometimes flared up into diverticulitis. And she would have attacks of it, but in the past she was always able to sort of wait them out. But at that point, soon after the fall, she went into an attack that she wasn't able to fight off.
You know, I'm looking at one of your cartoons. It is hard to do through the radio, but there is this unbelievable drawing of your mother. And your mother says, hold on a minute while I look for it. This is obviously all for her collection. And then actually, do you mind reading? Perfect. Read your. This is okay. Roz Chass reading a cartoon about her having a phone conversation with her mother.
Well, it needs a little bit of background here. Because it also, in some weird way, I felt that I was at fault here because the reason she was on this stepladder was because I was telling her in that sort of weirdly braggy way that you do to your parents, even when you should be like well past this and much more mature. I was for work going with a friend of mine, she was going to write it, I was going to draw it, we were going to the Galapagos Islands. And in that sort of braggy, like, Mom, look what I am doing kind of way, I told her that I was going, and she said, oh, Daddy and I went to the Galapagos Islands about 30 years ago, and when we crossed the equator, we got a certificate from King Neptune, and I think it's up on top of the crazy closet. Now, the crazy closet was this closet in the middle of our apartment that sort of functioned as our attic, and it was just amazing all of the crap that was in that closet. It was like every piece of falling apart cheap luggage they had ever had, an old rexograph machine from my father's, you know, teaching days, stacks of unused, like, French and Spanish exams that he hadn't, like, given out, textbooks, and bathrobes, galoshes, pajamas, hats, everything you could think of, just crammed in there. And the idea of I think my mother was 93 at the time, the idea of her getting up on a step stool to find that stupid piece of paper was not something I wanted her to do. So, but she was extremely strong-willed and compulsive. So here's the cartoon. I'm talking to my mother on the phone. I've just told her about this. She's explained to me that she wants to go and get the certificate. And she goes, and this is my mother, hold on a minute while I look for it. And this is me. Mom, please do not look for it. I don't want it. Please do not climb to the top of the crazy closet. Promise me. And she just goes to the phone. She goes, and hangs up. You know,
with a great look on her face, by the way. It's almost a mischievous look, like, that's
yes,
where I'm going. I am making a beeline to that crazy closet.
I'm doing it. You got another thing coming. If you think that your, like, strong words from up there in Connecticut will have any effect on my not climbing the step stool, you don't know me, Miss Chass.
I just want to say this is the brilliance of your book, Roz, because, you know, people can write this, but you have the cartoons with the expressions and the whole and the images of your parents and yourself and sitting on these little couches. I mean, it just makes it perfect. It just makes it perfect.
Well, thanks.
So you ultimately get them in a retirement home, and obviously, ultimately, and I don't mean this to be cavalier or quick, your parents die. But then where are your parents?
For the time being, my parents, I have no idea where my parents are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is a whole other question. But their cremains, which is a really horrible word, are in my closet at home. I got them, I picked them up from the funeral home. And it's a very strange thing. I mean, you know, we don't have like a little spot on Cape Cod that we always, you know, called our own, where mother always said to me, you know,
When I die,
scatter my ashes on Granny's place. No, you know, we never had that in my family. We didn't talk about death. I did not know what to do with the cremains.
Sounds good to me.
Well, you know, Jim might be able to give you some advice on what to do with the cremains. Why don't you tell
my
Roz
mother
where you
is
are?
My mother's in a box in the back of my car, and she's been there for, I mean, she's relatively near me.
In the trunk.
And she didn't have a place either. She's
in the
trunk.
Do you like driving around with her?
I don't think about it much.
But
but occasionally, when I'm sorting through things, I find the box, and you say, your mother is in the back of your car.
See, I like having them in my closet.
Yeah.
Because I like my closet. And it's kind of, I don't mind having them there. And until I figure out a good place, like a place that makes sense, I don't mind. It seems less arbitrary than any other place I can
think of.
How do
they feel about you becoming a cartoonist?
How'd you become a cartoonist? That's what I'm dying to know, because people know you from the New Yorker, Roz. How did you become, you know, what you are?
Beautifully put, actually. That sort
really
of says it.
Yeah.
I mean,
you
were good at drawing in school?
I always drew. And I always liked to write. And I liked making pictures that made me laugh. And I thought I found things funny. And sometimes even if I was drawing something seriously, it would come out sort of funny. And
And then you sent cartoons in? I mean, you've earned a living as a cartoonist. So you sent them to where, the New Yorker or other places first?
Well, I started out, I went to art school. I went to Rhode Island School of Design. And first I never thought I'd be able to make my living as a cartoonist, actually. I never really did. The first place that I really thought that I would wind up working was maybe the Village Voice. And that was, to me, the height of all, because Jules Pfeiffer worked for them. My parents subscribed to The New Yorker, so I knew The New Yorker used cartoons, but I didn't see my stuff as fitting in with them. And my dream was to work for The Village Voice, and I was selling them some cartoons. But I was also starting out, I was 23, and I thought I should probably, you know, I was selling some to the National Lampoon, I was selling to The Village Voice. There weren't, you know, tons and tons of markets. And I thought I should try The New Yorker. I mean, because there was The New Yorker and there was Playboy, and that was even less relatable to. I mean, I did try at one point to do Playboy cartoons at the behest of the woman who was the cartoon editor, whose name was Michelle Urey, and they came out like parodies of Playboy cartoons, because I really, you know, they were like, I have bosoms. And, you know, I had no idea. It was like boss chasing secretary around desk, and you have, look at your bosoms. And yes, I do have bosoms. I really had no idea, like, what kind of, you know, humor to find in this. But anyway, so I thought, okay, I'll get together. I'll find out when the New Yorker has, you know, their drop off day. And I called them up, and at that time, this was 1978, they took things on Wednesday, like over the transom things. So I put everything I had, about like 60 cartoons. I had no idea how to do this at all. And I didn't have anybody to ask. I just sort of thought, okay, I'll put the cartoons in this envelope, and I'll put my card in it, and then I'm sure they won't take anything, and I'll pick it up the next week, but I will have tried. I wasn't even like nervous, because I was so sure that they weren't going to take anything.
How many before they took the first one?
They actually bought something from that group.
Wow. What did that feel like?
I was flabbergasted. I was just flabbergasted. And Lee Lorenz, who was the art director at the time, told me to start coming back to the to not just drop stuff off, but just to actually come in to the actual part of the magazine.
But haven't I have I read somewhere that we had Bob Mankoff in here a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about a whole bunch of people, including you. You've had, have you had 90, something like 90, we only have a minute left, like roughly 90% of your cartoons have been rejected by the New Yorker?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's, that's, but it's not me. I mean, I probably do as well as anybody there. I'm sure there's people who have even.
Oh, he told us that. It was by the way, speaking of that, in his book, and I know this is my, you have a cartoon that I, this, it's called Insomnia Jeopardy. Oh. And here are the categories. Ways in which people have wronged me. Strange noises, diseases I probably have, money troubles, what did I say, why did I say do that, and ideas for a screenplay. Can you relate to that, Marjorie Egan, or
totally.
Can you not relate
and
to
I
that?
Love the one about the everybody Velcroed to the wall.
The Velcro family. It's just unbelievable.
That's fantastic, too.
So, but answer my question before. We only have a minute. Oh. Were your parents okay with you being a cartoonist? Is that not like a real job for the family?
I think that they thought I would probably go into the family business, which was teaching. My mother was an assistant principal. My father was a French and Spanish teacher. And I think that they thought that eventually I would wind up doing that. So it was possibly as much of a surprise to them as it continues to be a surprise to me that I you know, thank God, because I can't teach.
It's not a surprise to us, Roz. New book, Roz Chast, it's a memoir. Can't we talk about something more pleasant? It is just,
it is an amazing book.
It really
is spectacular.
Thanks,
you want to get it for all your friends and certainly for yourself. Roz is going to be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7.
Great.
Tickets
bookstore.
Are sold out, but there may be some scalpers. You can also catch her tonight on Greater Boston with Emily Rooney. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Alex Beam and Secretary of Transportation Rich Davey. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in.